Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and this is the first episode of our What Is series, where we tackle topics of rising importance in technology and business, more generally speaking. We'll tackle what is artificial intelligence, what's blockchain, what is robotics, what is virtual reality, and the like. Today, my question is, what are microservices? To answer each of the aforementioned questions, I'll speak with a prominent venture capitalist who's investing in this space and a founder, CEO, who has a company in the space as well. Today, the venture capitalist is Matt Miller of Sequoia Capital, and the founder CEO is Jay Kreps of Confluent. Matt Miller is a partner at Sequoia Capital with a special emphasis on microservices. He focuses on growth stage investments in technology companies. He's also a business partner and growth investor at Docker Incorporated and serves on the boards of Confluence, Simply Safe, and Carbon Black. Prior to joining Sequoia, Matt worked at Goldman Sachs in their technology, media, and telecom group in the investment banking division. Matt has a BS in finance from Brigham Young University. I recently caught up with Matt from his office in Menlo Park, California. In our conversation, Matt defined microservices, discussed the advantages of going small to go big, suggested strategies for organizations beginning the migration to microservices, and discussed a variety of other topics. Please stay with us after listening to Matt to hear my discussion with Jay Kreps, a co-founder and the CEO of Confluent. If you're a CIO of a company with $1 billion in revenue or above, please join me for the Forbes CIO Next Conference at Forbes on 5th in New York City on October 15th and 16th. I'll interview CIOs who are also chief digital officers, like Clark Golestani of Merck and Ish Sundaram of JetBlue, CIOs who are also operations executives, like Kathy Bassant of Bank of America and David Thompson of Western Union. I'll also speak with entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and executive recruiters, all of whom are shaping the technology landscape. To register, go to forbes.com/forbes-live/events/CIO-next. I hope to see you there. Welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you today. The topic of the conversation, Matt, is what is microservices? I'd love to have a conversation just sort of defining the term, understanding why it is so meaningful, what the benefits are, et cetera. We'll get into all those details. But I hoped as a partner at Sequoia, somebody who's been investing in this space for some time and has been in related topic, even predating this as a major topic within technology, I thought we'd begin with the term. What is microservices? How would you define it?
Microservices is really the easiest way to go big by going small, to put it in simplest terms. What microservices is it's the taking of what may have been a large traditional application and breaking it into many smaller autonomous pieces that are defined as services that can operate uniquely across different use cases that you may have. And the benefit of breaking from one large or multiple larger applications to many smaller applications is that it's far more scalable. So you move smaller and you get bigger because you can scale these much more easily than you could before. It's also significantly faster to iterate on a small piece and make changes on small pieces over time. It's far more resilient because the systems are designed to be completely independent if there's a failure in one of these pieces. And so if something goes down, the rest of the system continues to operate. And so it provides better user experience than you may have had before. It's significantly less expensive than maintaining many of these monolithic applications that people have seen in the past and have worked with for years. And so it provides a lot of benefits for both the startup community that we work with here at Sequoia very closely, as well as the corporate Fortune 500 Global 2000 community that we also work with closely, as many of our companies are their vendors that help them solve some of their problems.
You've gone so far as to say that, I'm quoting you, microservices represent the biggest disruption we've seen in enterprise technology this decade. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what's behind the hyperbole in addition to the points you've already made.
The reason why that is the case is because microservices represents the successful insertion of a new layer of abstraction. And so at Sequoia, where we've been in the investing business for 45 years in technology, we look for these moments when there's these insertions of new layers of abstraction. Well, what does a new layer of abstraction mean? it really is another way of saying more defined specialization of labor. And if you think about when we have had more defined specialization of labor just as a society, it has led to huge increases in our agility and huge increases in quality of the products we produced while reducing costs meaningfully. And you can go all the way back to the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution to where specialization of labor has led to these changes. And if you think about that from a technology point of view, as we've gone from things like the mainframe to client server to cloud infrastructure to virtualization, each time that we have successfully inserted a new layer of abstraction, quality has gone up meaningfully. The time that it takes to develop applications has come down and our costs have come down dramatically. And from the Sequoia point of view, each time we have seen one of these layers of abstraction or one of these shifts occur, tens of billions of dollars of new market cap have been created in new companies and new vendors to help fuel and support companies looking to adopt this new paradigm that helps them operate their businesses much faster. So that's why we're particularly excited about it and why we think it's so disruptive. And for companies looking to adopt it, it's so disruptive because it's a huge paradigm step forward in the efficiency that you can gain in building your applications. And really, you can operate your business, the technology aspects of your business, which is increasingly more and more of your business, at a much faster rate than you could before.
You've defined the benefits as agility, efficiency, resiliency, but also revenue. I believe you've covered the first three, but the revenue piece is also an important one. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the pace at which you can accelerate the innovation in your applications or services has a direct correlation with your ability to derive revenue from them. If it takes you a year to make a change on your site, which many legacy companies dealing with monoliths have that as a problem, or many older companies have that as a challenge, then it's going to be slower for you to catch up on a new revenue opportunity that a startup leveraging a newer architecture might be able to pounce on. And as we've seen many of these enterprises move towards this microservices approach so that they can iterate at a similar pace and capture revenue opportunities just as quickly.
Precursors that are now in place as you've defined them, containers, APIs, and scalable cloud infrastructure.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about each of those as the building blocks towards microservices?
Yeah, so the big one was containers in our mind. And really the aha was when Docker came out and containers started to move. When we really saw it was post the investment in Docker as we started to see some of the early customers that were using Docker. Microservices was around long before Docker, but the overhead of managing microservices, particularly in defining the interfaces in which how you would wrap or how you would define the outside parameters of a service, was more difficult because you had to come up with a standard and you had to run that standard through your company, educate everybody on that standard. But when the Docker container came, that was the standard and it was the universal standard. And it improved the complexity just a little bit and just enough that more and more companies were willing to experiment and try to build microservices. And it kind of was a tipping point from which we had a couple companies in the Sequoia portfolio playing with microservices to now near every company in the Sequoia portfolio is building some part of their environment in microservices. And almost none of the corporate customers that we engage with at Sequoia were doing it to now all the customers that were coming in here were asking us, hey, do you guys know anything about microservices? How can we take advantage of this? What can we do? Because they were able to play with the containers and able to make it work on a very small scale. So that was really the tipping point in which we saw that brought a lot more adoption. The availability of APIs was absolutely important and was kind of a required standardization to have this, but it occurred before the containers really became mainstream. And then the availability of cloud infrastructure, I mean, just the fact that you have compute on demand really is a huge enabler for this and many other things, you know, also played a significant role.
You work with a great number of startups, and naturally, many of them from the outset are using container technologies. But you also talk about older organizations who still have older technology in some ways and some critical areas for that matter,
yes,
making the transition. Obviously, that's a different proposition. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you've seen or heard of as some of the best practices in transitioning from sort of legacy technologies towards where relevant and appropriate microservices.
Yeah, so the first is just don't worry about doing it all at once, that you have to start with a very small piece and you have to create a dedicated team that is carved off and isolated to go build something new. And you give them this task of go build something new or go take this one application and help turn this one application that might be a monolithic application into a microservices one. And start small. The cases we've heard where people have gone very big or been very aggressive wanting to turn everything over quickly, they are fraught with failure. The more people you talk to, that you'll hear that as an example. I think Jay, you're going to talk to Jay Krebs. He can tell you about how biting off too much in that transition can be painful, and have some good examples. So that's one. The second thing is be careful in how you plan. Number one, make sure that the thing that you're going to move to microservices really warrants the increase in complexity that you will incur. So not every application needs to be microservices. Some things just are small enough or good enough as a monolith, but there are many cases where it does make sense to move, where it's big enough and you're going to make changes on it frequently enough and you need to scale it. So make sure that it makes sense and plan carefully around that. Also plan carefully around how you're going to break apart the pieces and do them in a very iterative way. So we talked to some of our portfolio companies that have made the switch, and they talk about, first we took off this one component and we broke it into a separate microservice, and the whole monolith worked as is, and then it called out to one microservice. Then we added a second, then we added a third, then we added a fourth, from 4 to 8, and then we went from 8 to 16, and pretty soon they had broken it up into over 100 microservices, their entire product offering, but they went slowly and iterated. An important component of this is to have somebody who is, or a team of people who are the artisans or the architects who sit on top to make sure you're not reproducing duplicate services, there's not overlap between your services, that things are being developed with some level of oversight and you don't have the services sprawl that comes out, and that you keep track of what's been developed, who's put in what, and the quality of the team behind this and that, so that there's somebody who has some sort of a broad organizational view, because when you break apart your teams and they just build these independent services, it can be a little bit of chaos without that. And that's one of the things we heard from people at Google and Amazon, was having these architects or artisans was really key. And we've seen many of the corporates that do it that's been successful. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the examples of things we've seen people do.
That's interesting. You also maintain a microservices ecosystem map, if you will, across a variety of different parameters, which is ever-growing. In looking at that map, as I recently did, it is, I don't know if it's comprehensive, probably not, but it certainly has a good definition of the various facets of technology that are relevant, and as well as players associated with those. In some ways, what is intimidating in seeing such a broad list is, where do I get started? You know, how do I think about building my own ecosystem? That is a broad ecosystem, and I'm sure you would not advise that everyone who looks at that engage all those companies.
Yeah.
How do you take that map and begin to think about a plan of action in building one's own personal ecosystem that is relevant to their enterprise?
Yeah, I think that the vendors who help with container adoption are the best first starting point. And of that, there are really three big ones. So we're investors in one of them, which is Docker. The team at Red Hat is also very big and has a very strong practice in the space. And also the team at Pivotal has a very good practice in the space. Those are three organizations where you could start and spend time with and develop a strategy for how you could make this migration. And they're core in that they have a lot of expertise around the core container technology, how you should think about orchestrating the container, how you think about leveraging Kubernetes and Swarm and other orchestration technologies to just make the basic container mechanics work. And then there are a handful of other vendors that you could go to for help. I think that I think Confluent is another interesting one, because Confluent in particular is a data streaming vendor that helps many of its customers connect the old world with the new and helps leverage data that may be sitting in your legacy mainframes and use that to empower a new microservices environment. And so they have a lot of expertise in helping people that are in this in-between world of they're going to have legacy, but they also want to take some of the benefits of the new. And then there's another company we're not investors in called Buoyant that focuses on this thing called the service mesh, which is a way of managing all of your microservices and knowing what goes where and who's done what. And they are a good guide to help navigate through this process, even though they're a very young company. They developed this service mesh technology, Linkerd, while at Twitter.
Hmm. Are there related disciplines, DevOps, for instance, or others that are kind of important or key to implement in concert with sort of thinking about microservices implementation more broadly speaking?
But I would say that DevOps is something that if you don't think you're doing it, you are misinformed, because you probably already are doing it. Mm. And it's just that your developers are running with it. And maybe there's some few and far corners of the world that are still not leveraging DevOps. But I think the nature of the world today is that developers are the new king or queen makers in enterprise IT. If developers don't love your product or service, you will fail. And it is developers that are driving a lot of the decision making, and developers have this inclination already for DevOps types approaches, and are probably already driving those in the organization underneath you. And so it is a very powerful trend, and I think it's a trend that almost everybody is seeing and reaping a lot of benefits from, but it's not a CIO-driven trend. Mm-hmm. And it's probably happening, even if you don't know it's happening beneath you.
In looking at the ecosystem and even looking through some of your recommendations on approaches to contemplate when implementing microservices, security comes up naturally.
Yeah.
And you can't have a technology conversation today without thinking about security implications of what it is that you're implementing. And I wonder if you could take just a moment to talk a little bit about the security implications of microservices, best ways to think about that, sort those out, et cetera.
So anytime you introduce more complexity, you introduce more opportunities for vulnerability. So that creates an increased need for better security with microservices. At the same time, with microservices, you have the ability to move from a stance of being very protective of your perimeter to very protective of your specific pieces. And as we're finding out that the perimeters that we've long held of guarding our network edges, those approaches are not working and not as effective as we may once have thought, it actually makes sense. And more organizations like Google are working to moving into protecting the core individual pieces and have these open security models of not counting on a reliable perimeter, but counting on the individual pieces of security. And so there are a couple companies that are focused on microservices or container security. We're investors in one, which is StackRox. There's another company called Aqua, and there's another company called Twistlock in this space as well. But these companies are bringing a new paradigm of, rather than focusing on the edge, focus on protecting the individual services. We'll help you with this increased complexity to make sure that you're protected, but we can also provide you better security in the application layer because we're moving the security focus from the perimeter down to the actual service itself and working on protecting the actual service, what's going in and out, who's accessing what, and are providing a much more granular level of security that's more efficient and I believe will be more effective than the perimeter-focused vendors have been.
I'm curious, as somebody who's so deep in microservices, somebody who works with several of the leading players, as you've noted, but also remains current, as is also clear, of the broader landscape, how do you educate yourself? How do you remain current so that you are not only a good advisor, in some ways, reacting to what you are hearing from the portfolio companies on whose boards you sit, while also being able to proactively provide thoughts about where the trend is moving? How do you remain current? How do you educate yourself,
et cetera? We talk to lots of people who are living this every day. So we talk to the engineering teams in our portfolio on a weekly basis. And those, myself and one or two of my colleagues who spend more time in Sequoia focused on infrastructure, we're talking every week to two or three portfolio companies. What are you doing? What are you seeing? What's going on? We're also talking to two or three Fortune 500, Global 2000 type companies every week. They come here, they visit Sequoia, they share with us what's going on, what's not going well, and help educate us a lot on what's happening in the market. And so we spend a lot of time doing that. And then we're meeting all of these new vendors on that ecosystem map and the many more that are trying to come into the market and hear their perspectives. And so between those three sources, we try to triangulate on our own view and perspective.
That's great. And are there any other, beyond what we've discussed, as you look out a year or two or three, do you see the evolution of this going in other exciting areas that we've not already covered?
Yeah, no, the exciting thing is kind of, we had this initial wave of Gen 1 companies, of which Docker and CoreOS were some of the first ones to move, and Mesosphere were some of the first companies to move into this market. Now we're seeing this general, like, we're going to do containers. Now what? What are the other pieces we need in microservices? Security is a big one. A lot of people are also spending time as to how should I monitor microservices, because now that you have gone from one heartbeat to lots of small heartbeats, it's more important to know what all the pieces are doing and what the health is of those pieces. And so that's leading to new approaches in monitoring that are actually really exciting and a big surge in interest in monitoring vendors. And so we think monitoring will be a category that will build a one or two more multi-billion dollar companies specifically focused on monitoring for microservices over the next 5 to 10 years. So that's an area where we're spending a lot of time. And it'll be interesting to see if some of these other areas like service mesh and data streaming, the opportunities that come here and as this ecosystem fills out. We're still in very early days. It's still the first inning. And there's a lot of great company opportunities here to build some great businesses that we at Sequoia are excited about.
Well, Matt Miller, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Matt Miller. Next, I speak with Jay Kreps, the CEO and founder of Confluent, a stream data platform powered by Apache Kafka. Prior to co-founding Confluent, Jay was the lead architect for data infrastructure at LinkedIn. He's among the original authors of several open source projects, including the distributed messaging system Apache Kafka and Apache Samza, a stream process system. Jay earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in computer science from the University of California at Santa Cruz. I recently caught up with Jay in Menlo Park, California, and we discussed the genesis and evolution of Apache Kafka and Confluent. Jay also suggested strategies and best practices for implementing microservices, highlighted the advantages of open source software, and shared his insights on a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. If you're a CIO of a company with $1 billion in revenue or above, please join me for the Forbes CIO Next Conference at Forbes on 5th in New York City on October 15th and 16th. I'll interview CIOs who are also chief digital officers, like Clark Golestani of Merck and Ish Sundaram of JetBlue, CIOs who are also operations executives, like Kathy Bassant of Bank of America and David Thompson of Western Union. I'll also speak with entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and executive recruiters, all of whom are shaping the technology landscape. To register, go to forbes.com/forbes-live/events/CIO-next. I hope to see you there.
Jay Kreps, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a pleasure. The topic today is microservices. What is it? What is the opportunity for those who are listening who might be technology practitioners, chief information officers, for instance? What's in it for them, the extent to which they're low on the rungs and pursuing this? And I thought we'd begin with your time at LinkedIn. You were at LinkedIn for 7 years, the last three as the principal staff engineer, and you came to microservices through that experience and then developed some key technology in the evolution of the topic, which we'll get to in a moment. But I wonder if you can talk about sort of the definition and opportunity as you saw it from those early stages at a fast-growing dynamic technology company like LinkedIn.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. It was as you said, so just as I joined LinkedIn in about 2007, they were starting the process of taking what was a big monolithic application that everybody put their code into and chopping it up into pieces and trying to figure out how to do that effectively. And this was, there's probably a lull in this kind of thing. There was an earlier wave of service-oriented architecture, which is pretty much the same thing as microservices. It kind of died off, and then microservices kind of came to the forefront again more recently, and LinkedIn was probably right in between those two things. But the goal was really to scale the software engineering effort. You know, we were adding software engineers. Probably most people in technology know that as you add engineers to a project, usually you get more done, but each individual engineer adds a little bit less capacity than the one before. And so when you talk about these really big projects with lots of people, really big applications, as you add people, you get slower and slower. And this is a fundamental problem. And when you hear people talk about microservices, they'll talk about, scaling for more web traffic, or they'll talk about, reliability. They'll talk about all kinds of other things. I think all of those microservices don't help. It really just helps the one thing, which is how can I scale my software engineering effort? How can I, add more money and turn it into more software at a kind of more constant rate, rather than having this declining marginal utility of each software engineer I add, where each person we add makes the entire team a little bit less effective. When LinkedIn was doing this, I think there was really not a lot known about best practices. And so LinkedIn made a lot of mistakes. Some of the senior leaders there have written up, some great descriptions of this. I think it was actually, one of the bigger mistakes for LinkedIn. It was a fast growth company. One of the most important things was to be able to create a product that really took this professional networking space over and be able to evolve that quickly. There was a lot happening in the social networking space, so it was competitive. More than anything, getting that kind of agility and speed was really critical. And so, I think it ended up working in the end. The end state was everyone could deploy their part of the application independently. They could move much more independently, but there was a bunch of kind of hills and valleys in between where, we made changes that were supposed to make us all more effective, but actually made us less effective. And there was significant evolution in technology that was required to actually kind of get the promise. I think people starting today actually have the benefit that a lot is known about what works and doesn't work. A lot of the tools around deployment, around the communication between services are now more built up. Definitely the genesis of Apache Kafka, that was one of the things that I was part of and that I'm part of now in my role at Confluent.
that kind of came out of that era, but there's a whole, you know, family of technologies that solve problems from deployment to how do you monitor your applications and make sure they're all running well, which is obviously much harder when you have so many of them, to how these applications communicate to each other and how you can ensure reliability and security globally when now you suddenly have many more moving pieces.
And you mentioned Apache Kafka there, the open source data streaming platform that we're involved in developing during your time in LinkedIn, certainly also now a part of the backbone of Confluent. Can you talk a little bit about the process of codifying that into that open source technology?
One of the things that we didn't realize at first at LinkedIn that we kind of came to realize over time was not all parts of the application are the same. And so, you know, there's a part of a website or, you know, mobile app like LinkedIn that's doing very fast kind of interactive lookups as part of a UI. And then there's a whole kind of back-end machinery that reacts to that and gets work done. And I think this is true in, you know, every type of business. So if you look at a retail store, there might be very interactive digital experiences, maybe the online side, but there's a whole machine that does, you know, reordering and inventory management and all the logistics behind the scene and analysis on pricing. And that back-end side of it is, and the flow of all the data between services, that is what we were struggling with that Kafka was aimed at. And so we had gone through an evolution where we tried, you know, a category of technology called enterprise messaging systems. We'd adopted a bunch of those, and we really struggled to make them work, you know, at scale for a large number of engineers and a large amount of data. We were struggling with just the flow of data now that we had all these microservices, each of which had their own dedicated databases. How does all that data come together, and how can you build a holistic piece that triggers off that? And so what we came up with was this idea of a streaming platform. And so the idea was any service could publish a message into this. Any change in a database could be captured here, and it would be reliably propagated, you know, to any other system. And so this handled really the whole asynchronous side of the business, everything that would happen, you know, a little bit later. Whereas the kind of, you know, quick lookups that would feed a UI might be just totally transient. This is the stuff that has to get done. And you see this a lot in financial services. You see it in areas like retail. You see it in areas like insurance, where a lot of their processing is things that has to eventually happen. It's less about quick lookups for a UI, and that's really where Kafka shines. You could see it as being kind of taking ideas from these messaging systems, you know, which was kind of a prior generation of technology, maybe kind of 20 years old in architecture. But there's products there from Oracle or TIBCO or IBM. Many companies will be running that at very large scale, but it's hard to really manage and do across a you know, large number of applications. You can see this also as an evolution of some of the data movement tools like ETL or whatever. You know, what we did was basically kind of take those two areas and blend them together and, you know, really put it on top of a modern distributed systems foundation. So you could do it across an entire organization and have all these teams work independently around these streams of data, have everything be totally real-time and driven off of that, but allow them to move totally independently and not have to coordinate with each other. And so this ended up being the backbone, you know, both for LinkedIn of all its kind of data flow, but because it was open sourced, it, you know, it's now in thousands of companies from the big kind of, you know, tech giants, the Ubers and PayPals and eBays and Pinterests. But now, you know, many of the largest banks in the world, largest insurance companies in the world, largest retail companies, telecom, and a whole burgeoning set of use cases around the Internet of Things, which are kind of all really exciting and very far from the social networking space. So although we had big hopes for the technology when we created it, I don't think we knew every place it would end up. It's been very exciting.
Very exciting indeed. One other sort of definitional term before we get into some of those very examples. You mentioned that service-oriented architecture was a related trend that seemed to have some legs and seemed to be taking flight for a time and then sort of petered out after a while. What was the difference between that time and now, given some of the concepts and some of the related ideas there? What changed to make this appropriate?
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of people try to answer that question. And, you know, I'm not sure that there is a crisp technical difference. If you ask an engineer, they always want there to be some technical difference that differentiates the two. But there was clearly enough differences, you know, just in the technology and the people and the approach that it's different enough, it deserves a new word. Probably the right way to say it is it's a combination of a new generation of technology where people re-implemented a lot of these older ideas and a rebranding, because I think a lot of the SOA, service-oriented architecture, attempts weren't totally successful. I think part of that was because, and you know, I say this even though I am myself a vendor, I think it was too vendor driven. There was a good architectural idea about how you could split up the functionality in a company. And I think the implementation of that has not really been tried at scale. And you had a lot of vendors who built something kind of, you know, in an enterprise software company and shipped it to a company and said, hey, we're going to come in and solve this big social problem of how all your engineers can work on software independently, and it's going to work. And the reality was it didn't. And so what I think is actually different about this newer generation of technology is that, you know, it came up in the trenches, right? The practices for how you build microservices are things that evolved in real companies that were building both technologies like Kafka or any of the other family of tools that kind of came up around this. And we're also applying those to the problem of scaling their software engineering effort. And so while there's probably not, you know, a real underlying technical difference, I think that fact that to solve these big social problems requires actually doing it. And it's very hard to do that in a vacuum. And so I think that's probably the biggest difference. And so now you can point to a lot of companies that have been extremely successful with, you know, large microservices deployments. In the absence of that, you know, it's always a kind of architectural idea in search of a problem to solve.
Roughly 3 years ago, you founded Confluent, a company you're now the CEO of. What was the inspiration for that? After your experience at LinkedIn, your experience in development of Apache Kafka, what was it about that? Why was the timing right to go do something yourself?
It was really interesting. So, you know, we had built Kafka, and we really had big plans for it. We intended for it to be an open source project as well as something used at LinkedIn, and we really felt there was this big gap in the center of kind of a modern digital company. Our analysis at the time was we felt like, well, there's a bunch of processing that happens kind of in batch at the end of the day. Maybe our data warehouse kicks off and it churns through data and it can do very sophisticated things. And then we have these databases that support these very quick lookups, and there's really nothing in between those two. And so, you know, our thesis was, look, the world is going to be moving towards these big company-wide digital platforms. There is really nothing that is targeting this kind of asynchronous space of streams of data, but that's where most of the problems for a modern business lie. And so that was kind of our belief. We said, you know, look, there should be something between data warehouses and OLTP relational databases or whatever. That space, you know, the only thing that was there was this kind of old junky technology that, you know, nobody really loved in the kind of messaging system or ETL space. So that was how we got started. Then, you know, we found at first only the Silicon Valley companies kind of got what we were doing, and we saw really big adoption among those companies. But as it started to spread outside of that, it was really fascinating to watch. You would get to talk to people who were implementing Kafka in their company. And these companies were going through really serious digital transformations, right? So they were, you know, these were typically traditional businesses in retail, banks. You know, they have an existing business. They see it as really essential, you know, to their survival that they be able to kind of transform how they operate. A part of that is this big platform shift, and there's a number of them. Microservices are maybe part of it. Oftentimes, cloud adoption is part of it. But I think all of those things kind of come together as kind of becoming a modern digital company. I think there's enough changes in how companies can use software and really bring it to bear on their core business problems, that there's suddenly a great deal of motivation in that. You know, we see it in companies we work with. You know, car companies are going through this incredible transformation where suddenly car used to be a one-time purchase and you bought it and you were done. And now there's an ongoing set of services and data that it produces. And they want to have applications that tell you, hey, you need to take it into the shop. They want to be able to collect live traffic data from these and feed it back and send you on better routes. And so there's this whole digital side suddenly to a car. It's not just cars, right? It's also boats and trains, and it's also the process of retail is evolving. Like, all across all these industries, you can see this happening. Part of that is companies are looking at how they do technology. And, you know, I think this is where the microservices aspect comes in. They realize, you know, like, we're actually not as fast and agile as we should be. And so if software is kind of an auxiliary capability, that may be fine. But if it's one of the core things we compete on with our peers, then we're going to have to get much better and we're going to have to get much faster. That's where I see these investments happening. And so we, just through open source, we were in contact with all these companies that were doing these really, you know, kind of revolutionary projects with Kafka. We realized it was a little bit hard to take this kind of low-level infrastructure engine and just go with it. And we felt, look, if this is going to actually go and kind of take over the world the way we'd hope, there needs to be a company that turns it into a real product. something that makes it, you know, where you can actually plug it into all the systems you already have. You know, the big difference between a LinkedIn and most other companies is they have, you know, an additional 30 years of technology that's doing valuable stuff, but has to be a part of this, you know, future transformation. And so some of our biggest projects are in the IoT space, which is quite new, but some of our other biggest projects are mainframe offload and plugging into all these much older systems so people start to, you know, open up that data, make it available to new services, make it available to systems that are in the cloud. It's just really interesting coming together of kind of the old and the new. And as we saw this, we just realized, yeah, there needs to be a company that turns this into a product and makes it much easier to adopt and to put into practice. And that was the genesis of the company. And, you know, we left to start Confluent then, and we've been, you know, growing it ever since.
It's interesting. In your earlier responses, you talked about how even you were surprised by the breadth of companies. You talked about financial services, insurance, retailers, healthcare companies, and beyond who do who, and this applied. The pivot from the digital native organizations you knew so well and came from, to these older organizations that had legacy applications through which critical data flowed, in some cases, enormous technical debt. How difficult was it to make the case for involving Confluent to organizations that might see this as a pretty heavy lift, and in many cases may actually be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't find the adjustment terribly difficult. Silicon Valley technology companies spend a lot of time recruiting, and it's very competitive. And as a result, they tend to talk up, you know, how wonderful their technology environment is. The reality is those companies are full of legacy too. It's just not as old. But, you know, it turns out the legacy from 5 years ago may be more painful than the legacy from 15 years ago. And so I don't think there's anything different about that. If anything, I found working with more established enterprises is actually more rewarding. Most of those companies have very significant businesses that are out doing something in the world. And so the ability to apply technology to that and advance it in some way is actually kind of more exciting. You can be working with, you know, companies that every single consumer in, you know, North America and Europe might interact with. And being able to actually, you know, help advance their product, I think that's actually extremely exciting. Oftentimes more exciting than, you know, smaller startups that really haven't gotten to the scale to make that impact yet. It's definitely a bigger lift in a bigger organization to kind of bring these new platforms into existence. And so I think it's primarily about whether there's the will or not, and is there a gradual path to get there? So at least from my perspective, I'm very, very suspicious of any technology that requires kind of a big bang rollout. You know, you need to have something that can be valuable for one application, you know, show value for one application and can grow to a second application and can spread from there as it kind of proves itself. Anything that's bigger than that, I think the case has to be exceptionally strong to undergo that. And so many of those kind of, you know, big rewrite the world initiatives, I think, don't really come to fruition. And so, you know, it's one of the things I like most about our model of working with companies, because, you know, we're centered around something that's open source, and our product is basically adding operational capabilities on top of that that allow companies to put it in production. You know, they can start very small. They can start with a few developers who can download the open source and put together at least some prototype of something useful. And as that goes to production, we can work with them on that one application. And as that grows, it can become a, you know, very central platform that they value, but they don't have to get there in one step.
Who tends to be the curator of that on your client side?
Part of the transformation that's happening is I do think developers and companies have more power. I think they're making more technology choices. I think what companies are looking for is a way to kind of let that go and be able to bring these software engineers to bear on their important business problems, but also have, you know, some kind of control on that, some kind of way of securing it and operating it and standardizing it across the organization and so on. So, you know, typically our adoption and involvement is going to be driven by a set of engineers that have a problem to solve. And, you know, all the people they report to kind of up the chain of command that are betting on this platform, you know, working for the application they've selected for.
And are there, as you've now worked with a great number of large organizations, as they have, and as you point out, oftentimes this works best in sort of piloting it, mm-hmm. finding small use cases, you know, establishing success and then building upon that success. Are there other kinds of advice that you would offer to those who haven't yet even dipped their toe in the water, or maybe are still in those early stages? what are some of the other differentiators that determine whether somebody is going to be successful in their
organization? You know, I guess there's two answers there. So I think our adoption is around, you know, a couple different vectors. Microservices is one of them. We end up coming in and replacing a lot of older messaging systems, you know, that kind of MQ series and whatever. You know, we have fantastic projects there with great ROI. When we look at projects that are going to be successful for us, it's usually just when there's some business driver, right? Strong ROI case, new area of the business. I mean, that's you can usually figure it out within 60 seconds of talking to somebody, whether it's a science project or a, you know, thing. So that's where I think Kafka and Confluent has been most successful. Where I think microservices are most successful is where there's real buy-in within the organization and a path to get that kind of from the lab to real life and kind of take it, you know, take it throughout the organization. I think that that type of thing is something that takes focus over a number of years. You know, it has to be done gradually, but in a dedicated fashion. One thing that I think you can't do with microservices is do it in a totally bottoms-up way where everybody just kind of does something different. I think you actually must come up with some standards of how these things talk to each other. How do we manage them? How do we deploy them? So getting that stuff right and then having a way of kind of gracefully onboarding a few things at a time so that the capabilities can be built up within the organizations. I think most companies we talk to that are pursuing microservices right now are often very early in that process. They have a few things maybe working that way at most. I think it takes time to actually carry that through to completion. And so I think the companies that are most likely to be successful are the ones that have the will to get there. And, you know, I think it's always difficult to have the will to carry through these types of core infrastructure transformations because, you know, there's no quarter-to-quarter pressure that you have to get the microservices initiative done to make your numbers. And yet you know over a period of time that if you're not kind of ahead of this digital transformation, you're really in trouble. And I think that's the dilemma for organizations trying to go after this. How can they actually maintain the focus and get there in a gradual way without derailing all their projects and kind of get to where they know that they need to be over the course of a few years while still getting everything done, you know, quarter to quarter that has to get out the door?
Obviously, the technology that the company is based upon began as open source, as we've discussed a couple of different times. And as you point out, it's critical, generally speaking, for technology companies and your own in particular, to be able to operate within an ecosystem. That mm-hmm. is to say, to be able to work with other technologies, with other vendors to the companies that you're serving. How do you think about that? How do you, as you are marking your own space, but also creating something that works well, plays well with other technologies, how do you develop that balance appropriately as you grow?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little different, I think, for us than for many other companies. We're lucky enough that we're kind of focused on a problem that not as many other people have focused on, which is how these streams of data flow. If I were to describe most of my kind of infrastructure technology peers, I would say they're mostly stores of data, and we're kind of streams of data. And so the streams actually work well with the stores. You want to hook all the stores up to streams so you can fill up your stores, right? So the result is we have an order of a few hundred partners, including technology integrations into just this vast array of different applications and systems out there, primarily because we solve a useful purpose used in conjunction. How do I get data out of that thing? How do I get data into that thing? How do I hook all these things together? And so it's an area that we've put our internal resources into, but it's also an area where I think open source is most effective. You know, we're actually at Confluent doing a fair amount of the development on the kind of core Kafka engine, just because it's a big replicated distributed system. It's hard to build. But all the integration into the hundreds of things that are out there, a lot of that is actual, you know, contributed by the open source community. And it's a way to actually be able to plug into all the things that a company runs. And I think that's one of the most essential things for, you know, any software product. It's always nice that you've made your little engine or your little widget, but how do you actually plug it into the, you know, the companies that want to use it into all the systems they have, and how can you do that effectively and efficiently? That's something we've put effort into really kind of curating the ecosystem, but it is absolutely kind of a ecosystem that isn't really built by one, you know, one individual company that kind of does it all.
I understand you recently hit an exciting milestone referred to as exactly once delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you look at how companies process data, right, you have a set of kind of batch systems that might run at the end of the day. And if you think about that, that's a little weird, right? So if you're a company, really of any kind, that's kind of a modern digital global company, what does the end of the day even mean? And what do these computers have to do with the sun coming up and coming down? And why is everything so slow? Well, it turns out that one of the things that holds that back is, you know, for a long time, it's been very easy to build complex data processing in this kind of batch way. And by batch, I mean, it's almost back to the mainframes where you kick off this big batch job and it churns through all your data and it spits out some results. And believe it or not, that's actually, you know, a significant chunk of the more sophisticated data processing in the back end of companies still works that way. So what's held that back? What's held it back has been that it's actually hard to take these things that happen, you know, once a day and make them continuous and still get the right answer, still get the, you know, the answer you would intend. Why is that so hard? Because as you're processing, of course, there could be some temporary interruption, some network glitch, you know, some server could get restarted, and you want to make sure you still get the right answer even if that happens. And so one of the things we've been doing at Confluent is really trying to bring the strong capabilities around data to this real-time environment. We want it to be usable, and a number of companies are using it for kind of core billing data, things that money rides on, where you must get the right answer, you must guarantee that everything goes through, and kind of failure is not an option, even if the servers, you know, some of the servers you're running this on happen to fail while the, you know, while the processing is continuing. And that's technically very hard. So it's something a large community of people have been working on getting into place over a number of years. You know, it's something that we added to Kafka and our platform in our most recent release. And what it does is make it really easy now to build things which are not just really scalable, but also are real time and get the right answer. And you would think, well, surely that's easy to do, but it turns out it's actually quite hard, and that's why you have this giant split between kind of the data warehouses of the world that, you know, load their data at the end of the day and the kind of real-time apps, which usually do something much simpler. And that's why people still have these big batch processes, even though, you know, we're really trying to get rid of the mainframes in those companies.
Jay Krebs, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Please join us next week when my guest will be Tasso Duval, the co-founder and CEO of TopTal, an online talent marketplace for top freelance software developers, designers, and finance experts. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not.
Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.